You're listening to a University of Minnesota Bookstore author event podcast, recorded live from our location in Kauffman Memorial Union on the U of M's Twin Cities campus. For more information on upcoming author events, please visit our website at bookstore.umn.edu.
Our guest today is Daryl Erdman. Daryl is an accomplished entrepreneur and business leader with more than 40 years of experience. He has founded seven businesses, including Rotab Corp, a restaurant chain for which he also served as president, and MEMS Technology, a medical device company. Most notably, Daryl was a lead developer of the entrepreneurial programs at both the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul and the University of Iowa. He was invited here by the Carlson School of Management's Entrepreneur Club to lecture to them today, and he's here with us today to talk about his new book, Scar Tissue: Lessons from the World of Entrepreneurship. So please join me in welcoming Daryl Erdman.
Well, we're a small group, so that makes it better, right? I spent 23 years of my life in businesses and starting businesses, and had the opportunity to move on to teach at the University of St. Thomas and develop their entrepreneurship program. So I thought that was an interesting new challenge, and resigned from three operating companies that I had ownership in, and my wife and I moved from Rochester, Minnesota to St. Paul, and I went to work at St. Thomas to start an entrepreneurship program. Interestingly, after I got there, I discovered the fact that there weren't any books to be had. There were life stories that entrepreneurs had written about their own life experiences, but no books that you could consider a textbook. Schools that offered it, I found 40 that had a course in entrepreneurship. I found four that had more than one course. Nobody had a degree program. So we launched with that, it was an interesting challenge, to say the least. And we began to develop courses one at a time, and that continued to grow. And we grew it, the program, into a full-blown major at the undergraduate level and a concentration at the graduate level, and eventually became a full-fledged department at the University of St. Thomas. From that program, we were able to graduate about 50 out of our program, counting graduate and undergraduate. There were 76 businesses that started. And we tracked the businesses, and we were running about a 93% success rate. So we knew that we were adding some degree of value to the students in their experience in starting businesses. We had a good time doing it. The students were fun, and I had the opportunity, after 13 years at St. Thomas, to go to the University of Iowa and start their program, which I did. And then after getting that completed, I moved into venture capital work, and I became a partner in a venture capital firm. We had a $47 million fund, and it took us about 6 years to get that invested. And after that, I decided that I'd had a good time, but I was going to do some writing, and I write a column for a business newspaper up north, and I also wrote this book. Now, the book, I've always believed that history teaches a lot of valuable lessons. Unfortunately, with business education, I've never found a university that offered a course in business history. And that was brought to my attention. My son spent a year abroad studying at the London School of Economics. And he was one of his major professors came over here on vacation. And so I got a chance to meet him and talk with him. And he asked me, he said, "How many courses in business history do you have at the University of St. Thomas?" I said, "None." He said, "Any other schools that offer business history?" He said, "No, not that I know of." Well, he was chairman of the Department of Business History at the London School of Economics, which is the largest business department in the London School of Economics. He said, I can't believe you teach business without teaching business history. And I thought that's an interesting perspective, and he's absolutely right, and we ought to have one. And I have to say, unfortunately, I never got one going. I couldn't get the history department interested in even developing one. But I began to gather information about just the history that our students had in starting, and other people, myself, the experiences of myself and other people that had started businesses, about the pitfalls that they bumped into as they started businesses. And in most of the cases, I was looking for not the things that cause complete total failure, because sometimes those are unforeseen and there's nothing you can do about it. But it was the little things that occurred that I thought would be best to teach and teach students about to save them the perils of experiencing them for the first time, even though somebody else had done it many times before. So we brought a lot of that into the program. And so when I came around to writing my book, I had this list that I had developed over time of some of, I call them scar tissue events, because the incidents that happens generally won't cause failure unless you compound them, but they'll definitely cause a setback. They can definitely cost you money. They can probably cost people's jobs, and it's not fun to go through. And there's no need to go through them. Since other people have done this already and made these mistakes, why not learn about them? So I put them all together. I put 24 of them in the book. I've got a few more than that, but I thought, I'm going to quit with 24. I picked the 24 best ones, I thought. And just to give you a quick example, one that I used is what I called a misplaced value. And what happens a lot of times is people develop this idea or concept for a service or a product, and they think it's just wonderful, and they're afraid to share it with other people. They feel that the total value of this business is contained in this one little product. So they do not acknowledge that it takes capital, it takes the work of a lot of other people with you in order for you to achieve success. And so there's a tendency or an unwillingness to give up part of the value that you're creating to other people who are helping you put it together. A prime example I've used is a medical device company that I helped start. The founder of that company had invented a medical device that facilitated wound healing. Basically, it would double the speed that a wound would heal, like surgical wound or even an injury you might have. This person said that he thought that if he gave up 10% of the company, they ought to raise enough money to fund the company. And I explained to him that with a medical device company, it takes years for success to be achieved, if ever. You have to go through this long approval process with the FDA, do lots of clinical studies. When you're done with that, you have to be able to get reimbursement approval from the medical insurance industry, because if they refuse to reimburse, you're not going to be able to sell your product. So it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of money. We assessed that it would take, at least initially, to begin the clinical trials that we had to do, about $500,000. Well, we went out and raised the money, and in order to get the money, he eventually gave up 40% interest in the company. He was really upset about having to give that much up. And I said, before we're done with this company, if it becomes successful, you're lucky to have 3% left. But if you're willing to do that, that 3% is going to be worth a lot of money someday. He didn't see it that way. And so the $500,000 got chewed up in running clinical studies, and we were sitting with no money in the bank, and he refused to share any more equity to raise more money, and in fact left the company. And he said, I don't care if it ever happens, which is really a bad way to look at it. I mean, you know, the objective is to grow something beyond the limits of your personal control. So he left. Eventually, we were able to sell the company to another company who did make it a success. And fortunately, the investors came out okay in the end. It took 10 years to have that happen, but it did eventually work out. This individual didn't end up with anything out of it because when the company was sold to the acquiring company, he eventually sold his interest for $250,000, which is all he got out of the company. And probably all he deserved to get out of it because he fought. This company could have been hugely successful had he been willing to share equity and share an interest in the company. And that's just, you know, one example. And another one that comes up is when you initially price your product or service. And I've seen so many entrepreneurs who have a tendency to survey the marketplace and think, I have no overhead now. You know, we're operating out of the house, the bedroom, the garage. I don't have any overhead. If I have any employees, they're probably donating a lot of time and services to help me. So now, when I go out to the marketplace, I can really undercut the competition in price, which they do. And yes, it will cause some initial success. But what happens is you begin to accumulate and build overhead like your competition has got because you're growing. And now you don't have the margin from your product to pay for that. So you're losing money. And the most important thing is to figure out the highest price you can sell it for by putting enough value into that product that's worth more than what the average product gets in the marketplace today. But you have so much value that people recognize it and they're willing to pay more for it, allowing you to have a little higher margin, allowing you to have a profit. So that was another scar tissue event that I ran into in the early days. We invested in a company that was, it was a group of engineers who had built a database of weather information from the U.S. satellite. And they had 40 years of U.S. weather built into this huge database, supercomputer. And they were able to build models from this to do weather forecasting. But they hadn't quite developed a product yet, so we worked with them. They developed a product. We went out, and there just wasn't a market for it. You couldn't find anybody interested in buying the software. It became a software product. So as the company struggled and they were looking to find a viable product, the fellow who was CEO of the company at the time happened to attend a wind energy conference. At the conference, in a breakout session, there was an industry expert discussing wind energy and its future. And they said, it's got a great future. The only problem is it is really difficult to roll this out. And it costs, in order to find a location, a site for a wind farm, $4 to $5 million. Because you got to put up at least 3 test towers, measure wind velocity at various altitudes on the tower, and accumulate the data, and that takes 2 to 3 years. $4 to $5 million investment. Our CEO was sitting there, he raised his hand, he said, how about if we could furnish you that information for, say, $25,000, turn it around in about 2 weeks for you with a 97% accuracy? Would you be interested? Well, who wouldn't be? Going to save $4 to $5 million cost. But if you think about that, essentially what he did is he left all that value on the table. He essentially gave it back to them, and for $25,000, we couldn't even make a profit on it. And he said, I asked him why he did it. He says, well, I'm so excited about a chance to sell it. You know, he said, I want to quote a price to get their attention. I said, well, you got their attention. I mean, phones are ringing off the hook. I mean, people wanted to come buy it. But we knew we couldn't make any money at it. So we had to begin to add improvements and added value. So we gradually inched the price up. It took 3 years for that company to break even. Eventually it did. But it was a huge setback. And it cost the total investment in that company to get to that break-even point was $4.5 million. And it probably could have been done for $2.5 million. And the people who founded the company had to give up a lot of equity to get there. And that wouldn't have had to happen had that CEO just thought a minute, said, well, if you had offered it, I told him, I said, if you had offered it, you could have easily sold it for $250,000, not $25,000. And I said, that would have been, that would have made the company profitable instantly. And he hadn't thought about that. So, and one other scar tissue event that I like to talk about is what I call the fear of the open kimono. And what I mean by that is that young and early, not necessarily young, but early entrepreneurs, new entrepreneurs, have a tendency to be afraid that somebody they talk to could steal their idea. Doesn't happen very often, if at all. I mean, occasionally I've heard in my lifetime, 40 years of working in entrepreneurial events, I know of one occasion where an idea was stolen. And that's after seeing and working with and looking at hundreds of early stage startup companies. So it's pretty rare. And the benefit of exposing your idea to a lot of people is to get feedback, particularly people that have relevant experience in the industry that you're interested in coming into. And then as you gain that feedback, you're able to keep massaging your idea to make it better and increase your odds for success. So it's important. I always told my students, I said, talk to as many people as you can, everybody that you can get your hands on. So I think it's critically important to be totally open about what you're doing. The the book, as I said, has 24 of these various events with its examples like this. I think I might just mention one other one that I think is kind of interesting, and that is to pull off a fairly significant entrepreneurial event. I mean, create a really great company. You got to have a team. You can't do this alone. There's just too much work to be done. There are too many skills to be covered, and no one person can have them. So you got to build a team, and it's critically important in the early days that the team members you bring in are highly skilled people that can cover skills you don't have. And so that means do not, under any circumstances, grab your next-door neighbor or your beer-drinking buddies to come help you start a business. It just doesn't work. I had a student who started a business. His million-dollar idea happened to be soybean oil. He lived above an Asian food store while he was going to school. He had a high school friend who was his roommate. This friend dropped out of high school and was working at a convenience store, but these two guys roomed together above an Asian food store. They shopped in the Asian food store. They noticed Asians buying soybean oil in quart jars or quart containers for cooking purposes. And he says the prices they pay are obscene. And he said, I went and priced a 55-gallon drum of soybean oil, and I can repackage that in half-gallon containers, sell it for the same price as a quart jar, and make good money on it. And I said, how are you going to get it out of a 55-gallon drum into a half-gallon container? And he said, well, we'll figure it out. And they did. And so these two guys were distributing this to Asian food stores around the Twin Cities and out of the trunks of their cars. And things were going Yeah, reasonably decent. They were making some money on it until they had the opportunity to get a larger quantity of soybean oil, because a student discovered on a siting down in St. Paul, there was a tank car full of soybean oil. So I said, we can get that, and we can, the owner wants to get rid of it in a hurry, and we can get it really cheaply. So they went forward with getting it. I also reminded him one more time, you got to get it out of a tank car into a, you know, half-gallon container, but they weren't worried. They figured it out. And then the Asian stores that they were supplying requested other products that they weren't able to buy, and so I helped them source those products and find where they could get them, introducing them to food brokers on the West Coast. And so they started importing some products, and the thing went along pretty good, except about 3 years into this, my student came in to me and said, I got a problem. I said, what's that? And he says, my partner isn't worth anything. I'm paying him a six-figure income, and all he does is sit in the office. He doesn't do anything anymore. And I said, I warned you about that. I said, you pick your partners carefully. And I said, you've outgrown his ability. And so I told him in the beginning, I said, before you hand him any equity, you know, look at the skills he's bringing to the table. And he had made the mistake of giving this friend 25% interest in his company. So now he's got to get rid of him somehow. And he ended up eventually negotiating to buy him out. It cost him $250,000 to buy him out of the 25% interest, which set his company back in its growth cycle at least 2 to 3 years. Fortunately, he had enough momentum. He stayed going, built the company out. Company is Asian Foods. You've seen their trucks around, I'm sure. Sold out to Cisco Foods a few years ago for $40 million. So he made a success out of it. But that success may have been greater or may have been sooner had he hadn't made that critical scar tissue decision of bringing in a partner too early. So, lesson learned. Any questions anybody has, I'd be happy to answer them. We could chew on some of these stories all day long, but anybody thinking about starting a business? How about you? No? Okay. It's a fascinating world, being self-employed. I had one of my students tell me one time that the best thing about entrepreneurship was that he never had to worry about getting a job. And that's essentially true. He says, you can go out and create your own. There's all kinds of opportunity. Opportunity never goes away. Changes.
What percentage of these small companies fail?
It depends upon the type of company. The failure rates that are quoted in the paper are absolutely false. Generally, if you're going to take an overall average, it's probably someplace in 35-40% range, not 90, like you see quoted. But it varies all over, because if you're starting a high-tech company versus a corner grocery store, how do you compare those two? I mean, it depends on the type of industry you're in, the amount of money it takes to get it launched, all kinds of issues and factors. So each industry segment should have, they don't really break it down this way, but should have their statistics different. As I mentioned earlier, I don't think you were here. The program at the University of St. Thomas, we had 76 students start businesses out of there with a 93% success rate. So that's a 7% failure rate. That's not too bad. I felt we were able to give them enough mentoring and guidance to help reduce some of those scar tissue lessons and help them over the hump and help create success. But
how much money do they have to have?
There again, what kind of business you want to go into? You know, everything from nothing to a whole lot. The medical company I talked about earlier was $500,000 to get started. That's a lot of money to raise from the get-go.
If they raise $500,000, what are their obligations to the
The investor in a small company like that usually has to wait until the company either goes public or gets sold to recover their investment. The $500,000 investment that went into that company, when that company was eventually sold about roughly 10 years later, got a return of 10 to 1. So for every dollar they put in, they got $10 back, which isn't too bad a return.
Do they buy into the company when they invest?
Sure. Sure, they own stock, equity. Not much different. It's not any different than buying stock in the stock market, except this is privately done. And, you know, you don't have the oversight that you do in a professionally run company in the stock market. It's a lot, naturally, there's a lot higher risk. And that's an issue. And that's why there are restrictions on the type of people that can that are allowed to invest in startup situations. They have to have high net worths, high average net income, things like that. Those are hurdles that are in place by law.
How do you find these people, these partners?
Well, we call it, we call it the angel network. They're called business angels. The majority of them that do this are probably former entrepreneurs who sold their companies and have a degree of personal wealth. They're interested in helping others get their companies started. I would say that's probably as much as 80% of them. Some of the people that invest in private companies are people that just have a lot of family money that are interested in doing this. Or have other access to capital. But the vast majority are probably former entrepreneurs who have been done very well and are willing to spend a little money to help others get their companies going.
Are they usually local people?
Pretty much, yeah. Because people, at least I've found, that the business angels I know are like to be able to be close enough to their investment to, you know, stop in and kick the tires once in a while. You can't do that if the company is located in California. They like to be close enough to watch what's going on. So I would, generally speaking, it's not universally true, but generally speaking, the majority of business angels are local people.
That people who are working full time are able to somehow make that
leap.
That leap, yeah.
Yeah. You have to get confidence in your parachute when you step out of the plane. That's going to open. It's interesting. I can name a lot of people who started companies kind of on the side, and they grew and grew and grew, and they were able to make the transition out into the company. And there are people who say, but that's a slow, hard process. If you're really committed and you do it, just do it, get out, get it going. It works better to have complete, full-time, focused attention to it. And there's some truth in that. And again, you know, this is all relative, dependent upon the type of thing that you're doing. If you're starting a consulting business on the side using the skills that you got, you can do that part time. I mean, that's not that difficult to do. But if, you know, you want to start a retail store and you got to be open a lot of hours and things like that, that's entirely different. So then you got to devote a lot of personal time and effort to it. The same way with technical type things. A lot of those can be developed on the quiet, on the side. If you're developing software, if you got those skills and things like that that you can do before you make the giant leap. So it depends a lot upon the type of industry that you select. today, with the internet and the amount of companies on the internet, I mean, I know all kinds of people that started companies in their bedroom, you know, with their computer, working at night, working weekends, and a lot of them have become quite successful. And then you can make that decision if you want to make that transition and step out and go forward. As I say, it depends on the kind of time consumption, probably more than anything, that you have to give it. And particularly if you have an idea that you know is going to have to involve a lot of other people to help you get it to success, then you need to provide oversight, and are you going to have the time to provide that oversight plus do everything else that you need to do? So that's, and you can sometimes, in the startup process, when you develop your business plan, you know, if you think it through carefully, you can design it so that you can, you know, develop it in stages, and after you got it on paper and you look at it, you know that, you know, let's say you've got four stages, and you know that by the time I get number three done, I got to think about, if we're still doing well, I got to think about leaping into this thing full time. Yeah, but that, you know, if you put time and effort into the design of the concept, sometimes you can get that done. I had a friend who started a company. This was a technology-based company, and he wasn't. His expertise was in marketing. He knew nothing about technology, but he saw a gap in products that, like thermostats and valving that controlled, like refrigeration equipment, that the technology was really back when he started. Of course, this is 20 years ago. But the technology was kind of behind the curve. It wasn't employing the amount of electronics that he thought they should be. So he had friends who were engineers, and he just invited a group over one night and got talking about it, and they all recognized this too. So he said, I'd like to get the company started. I don't have any money. I don't know anything about technology, but he says, all you guys work for large corporations, you design products every day. These are electrical engineers. And he said, I've got an idea for several products and I can get more. But if I give you these ideas and you develop them into a workable product for me, and if I get enough of these designed and put together where I can, you know, farm out the manufacturing of them, and we'll go to the market with them, and I'll give you a lifetime royalty on that product. I can't pay anything for it, but you get a lifetime royalty. And all you got to do is work on this part-time. To a person, they all agreed to do it. And he got about a dozen products developed before he even did anything. And he basically, he found somebody to manufacture them, started peddling them. But that was his expertise, marketing. And today that company does about $75 million a year. And by the way, he's got his own engineering department now. But, it's amazing what you can do with very little if you think about it creatively. And there are ways to leverage knowledge and expertise to get things started. Any other questions?
How do you meet these people with the ideas?
How do you meet them? Well, all the contacts I've ever had in life are people I already know who tell me about, you know, somebody doing something, and go knock on their door and talk to them. I think all of us have friends and associates that know people. I don't have a week that goes by that I don't have two or three people contact me either with email or a phone call and say, hey, I'm thinking about what do you think, and that type of thing. It's ideas are all over the place. And it's basically built on contacts, people from school, friends.
They want to know it's marketable, right?
Pardon?
They want to know that it's marketable.
Well, that's the, a lot of them are just testing the idea. You know, like I said earlier, you talk to as many people as you can. So the people who are smart about getting something started are telling everybody about it and talking about it, and you know, one thing leads to another. You pick up leads, and usually, you know, if somebody talks to me about something I don't know anything about, I say, yeah, but I know, you know, you got to call George over here. I'll give you his phone number and talk to him because he's got, you know, knowledge about this particular market or this particular industry. And so he goes and talks to George, and George says, well, yeah, talk to somebody over here, and things get bounced around, and it's, you know, it's a, if you never networked like that, it's hard to, you know, it's hard to step in from the outside sometimes. But once you get started and you build up your contacts, it's pretty easy, really easy. Any other thoughts or questions?
Well, I was thinking the closest I've come to this was before I started with the U about 7 years ago. I was doing professional organizing.
Okay.
But I was working at a full-time job that I had a lot of flexibility. And so I could rearrange my hours with my full-time job,
mm-hmm.
and then still do this as a part-time job. And I worked with a professional organizer in town who was very well established.
Okay.
And so I was basically assisting her.
Mm-hmm.
So she was getting clients, getting me set up to go out and do, and then I had a few of my own clients, but it was
limited
part-time. But I look back, and the most I made that year was $5,000, and I'm thinking, you know, all I needed was a car, basically, to do, and some supplies. Very limited amount that you have to do this. Other than the skill to work with your clients and to really help to guide them through that process.
Sure.
So I've thought of, but I really don't want to go back to that. But that's, it really was wonderful. I mean, it was wonderful to know that I had that kind of flexibility.
There are a lot of businesses, you know, like that, where unless you can scale them up to be large enough, where you have basically people working for you, it's very difficult. There's not enough hours in the day for you to make, you know, a substantial income off of it. I have a daughter right now in a business like that. She provides a service, and you know, she's struggling to make a living at it. She's very good at it, and I says, until you build it large enough where you're able to have other people doing what you do, and well, they can't do it as good as I can. Well, yeah, they can if you train them. And you're not ever going to become, you know, successful enough. And I said the problem with doing it, that type of business alone, a service-based business, is that if you're sick, you're out of business. And so if you're able to get it scaled and figure out a way to do that, and of course, the issue there is you've got employees, you've got training, you've got oversight. I mean, the headaches grow, but that's the only way you're going to get a, you know, a business big enough that puts enough value, or creates enough value, to give you something to have a decent income, and maybe in the end to even sell to somebody else. And that's usually the objective to try and. So. There are a few people that do, and I call it income replacement. You know, figure out, well, I make $100,000 a year, so what can I do to make that much using the skills I have? And that's okay, except for the fact that there's no value built. So when all said and done, you turn out the lights, walk out, and you've had nice income. However, you haven't built any value. So, you know, you've got retirement issues to think about. You've got all kinds of additional things that haven't been covered yet. So it's good when you when you develop any concept is to figure out how can we scale that up to build enough value or create value over and above whatever salary I can draw out of it. It's got to be above your salary. And so that usually, I mean, is going to involve other people and the issue of management and all those good things. But can be done. We got books for sale. But I, as I say, I've spent a lifetime. Outside of the time I took out to teach, I mean, I always worked for myself. And from the day I left college, I never worked for anybody. And in fact, when I went to teach at the University of St. Thomas, it was a strange experience. I had to sign a contract. And the president of the university, when he slid the contract across the desk, he says, "I'm sorry to tell you, but I only offer you a one-year contract at a time." I said, "I've never had a one-year guarantee of a job and salary in my life, so that's great, you know." But it is fun being on your own. Scary sometimes, but still fun. Well, thank you. Thank you for coming.